How many of you don't know who I am?
I've seen your name spelled a couple of different ways.
Okay. I'm Glenn Mogelson. I'm from Los Alamos National Laboratory. My background is in fusion energy. I've worked in that area for 15 years. I was an astrophysicist initially, got my degree from the University of Colorado. Today is a different sort of topic, one that I think is going to be the most difficult for me to talk about. I think by the time you're finished here, you understand why I find this difficult. I would like to begin, however, by leaving you with some illustrations of images of God. My discussion, although I haven't talked specifically about the image of God, there are images that I have that coincide with the care of the earth, that relate to everything that I've talked about since I've been here. But I'm going to start by actually talking about a lot of different images for you to take back with you. The first image was from a conversation that I had with a fellow named Roger. Roger was in a minimum security prison. He was in there because he had robbed a bank. He had been there about 5 to 10 years. I can't remember exactly now. And he said to me that he had a lot of time to think about what was important to him. And he concluded that by this time that the most important thing to him was his relationship with his family and his children. And he had a great joy every time I brought my daughter with me. He would set Sarah in his lap and hug her and hold her. In the same context, I knew a man who committed murder. His name was Bob Hammond. I got to know him for many years. In fact, I knew him for about 6 years overall. And through those years, we learned to talk about things that were important. And even got to the point where we wrote to one another. And I'll never forget one letter I received from him. He had about a fifth grade education, and by this time he was about 48. He had been in prison about 27 years out of the 48 years of his life. He wrote me a letter and said, "You know, you really shouldn't spend all this time with me. You need to spend the time with your children, with young people. I'm gone. It's too late for me. Spend the time with children." A third image that was given to me by my pastor, and I'll see if I can get through this. He came in and visited my wife about a week before she died. And he told me this. Fran was conscious, and she looked at Calder. Calder was the name of the pastor, and she said, "You know, I feel like a trapeze artist. I'm swinging back and forth. I'm afraid to let go. And Calder looked at her and said, remember Christ's words into your hands. Now, I don't know how many of you have read anything by Kubler-Ross, but she has looked at people who have experienced a near-death situation. And one of the things that she's identified is Christ or something, some power with light. Light always seems to come up. White light, yellow light, light. Just before the person is going to take the last step, it seems. And if you have read C.S. Lewis's books, there's one of them, I forgot which book it was, that has an angel, and the angel is light almost, form of light. The image that has come to me this week that relates those images, now those are all different images of God, I think, and you know, you have to think about that yourself. But the one that's come to me this week is the image of the greatness of God, seeing God contained in the sun and the earth, the atmosphere. And I don't know if I'd call it coordinating, but you know, everywhere, and how the sun interacts with the earth, and how the sun is the energy for the earth and the energy for life, both human life and plant life and sea life and animal life. And there's this wonderful complex reality of God in that also. And so when I'm looking at energy ethics, I'm looking at it from the standpoint of how are we a part of that? How are we a part of the universe that God has created, the earth, and that interaction between the earth and human life? Now, I'll have to say that one of the reasons why this is difficult is because when I see what's happening, I have a lot of hope, but I'm kind of discouraged too. And let me see if I can begin to get you to think about why. These are just a bunch of questions. Just for a moment, how does energy affect our lifestyle? Howard?
It's all essential.
Hmm?
Okay,
Mark?
It's all essential.
In what way?
In what way? We don't function without energy.
Right.
We don't function the way we would like to.
Through food, right? We get energy to walk and and so on. How about other ways? What are some other ways that energy is important to us?
Communication.
What? Transportation. Heating. All kinds of things.
Medical care.
Is our lifestyle consistent with God's commandment to care for the earth? And we've talked about garbology. We've talked about the pollutions that we put into the water and into the air. But we do a lot of good things too. And there's this balance that you need to take into account. So, question mark. What is a meaningful response to God's creation? It's where are we? What are we trying to do in recycling, for example? Is that a meaningful response? Do we need to change our lifestyle? The last thing I'd like you to think about for a moment. I'm not going to say anything for about a half a minute. What is your vision of the future?
I think they have a lot of apathetic people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's going to reach a point where people are going to have to do something.
What is your vision, though? What is your vision? Somebody want to share?
I think there are going to be some scientific breakthroughs that will countermand and offset the things that are happening to the Earth now. We'll have some help the Earth in the future.
Okay. Someone else?
I relate back to a PBS special by James Burke that was done earlier this year, late last year, I can't remember, I think it was October last year, on laying out two dynamics of what maybe it was looking into, I think, the year 2010, 2015, and laying out what could be the possibilities for the Earth if we, first of all, laid out the negative scenario, that if we didn't do things to change our lifestyle, that the Earth would be virtually obliterated by that time. And if we consciously were willing to make very hard choices, but ones that would be in concert with creation, that would be a very positive one.
I think we'll look back on the year 2020 as the Dark Ages, followed by another Renaissance, when we look back to the year 3000.
Okay.
We will have satellites in which there will be continual life. That will be their world. There will be population of Mars.
Okay. Go ahead.
We'll be outpopulated.
I think our future depends entirely on our population. Control, if we do or don't. If we don't control it, it's going to see us constant decline in lifestyle. We're seeing it right now. And as nations try to emulate us, which is the goal of everybody on this earth, is to try and live like we do, I think you're going to see just a tremendous amount of increase in pollution and destruction of the earth.
Okay.
If the population is controlled, then we can actually maybe decrease the population of the world, then we have a bright future. But it all centers around that. That's the fundamental problem. And it's built into our human nature to reproduce. Yeah. That's the problem.
What I'm going to talk about now is some material that I first became aware of from Gerald Barney. And if you're interested in learning more about this, I would recommend you picking up this book in the resource room. His article is the first one in this book, and this is a discussion of the future of the Earth and what the implications of population growth are, for example. Let me go into that and try to give you a sense of of how things are related. Population growth, a population means that you have a certain amount of land which you set aside for growing crops and other things to feed the people. Now, how much land you have to have depends on the yield that you get per acre. Okay. Now, particularly in our country, the yields depend very much on your energy. That is, the gasoline that you use and the energy that you use for making your fertilizers or whatever else you're doing in the agricultural process. And as we learned at my last talk, the energy has an impact on the environment. And if you want to be efficient, you want to minimize your energy use. And so there's a cyclic process here. If you increase the population, that means that the one of two things, either you have to have more agricultural land, or you have to increase the yield. Okay. And if you increase the yield or increase the amount of land, typically means you're using more energy. At least that's the scenario right now, which means you have more pollution. And so this is the problem that you're talking about. All of these are related, and our population is growing at a substantial rate, to the point that it's estimated that we'll have 10 billion people by about 2040. 10 or 12.
And the current rate is what?
I think it's about 5. Yeah, it's about double. I thought, you know, we talked about this yesterday, but I thought it would be, who's from Washington here? Is anyone?
Which
well, state? Washington State.
Hey.
That's right. This was kind of disappointing to me. This is areas where the ozone criteria isn't met, and you can see that the whole area from Seattle to Olympia is one of them. Right. That was
from the automotive emissions or what?
Let's see, for the ozone depletion, I don't believe so. I'm not sure what it's from. So, what's a solution to the population growth? As you mentioned, one of the things is to stop the population. Another thing is to preserve the lands that are agricultural. And in addition to that, or doing the best to do both, but if you can't do that, then you increase the yield.
Yes, but presently we can only produce enough yield for about 6.6 billion people.
Yeah,
so
I know.
Control is still.
Well, we can talk about that. That's certainly something that some people suggest. We need to provide the energy for the agricultural use, and as you just mentioned, you know, if you take all the land presently, it can support maybe 6.6 billion people. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
And you want to protect the environment, even though you're using the energy. So, the question, or the one of the things that you ask yourself is, if I'm going to stop the population growth, how do I do that?
What this discussion is, the broader questions here, sort of like the feedlot mentality, though. As long as we can feed people, we can grow them like we grow cattle. You know, it's just not to me. There's more to life than simply eating.
No, I agree. This is only one aspect of it. This is probably the bottom line, though.
Yeah.
You have to have enough money.
That's the feedlot approach.
Right.
Yeah. limit, you know.
That's right. That's correct. But I go back to what you said. What you need to do is you need to control the population growth. Now, Howard, would you argue that it would adjust itself? Is that right?
They say it'll adjust itself.
Well, let me suggest something. And I believe this is true. You can argue about it, but suppose that you were in a situation like some of the countries in South America or India, and you were asked to only have two children, but your living conditions weren't changed. You were just told that, you know, you can only have two children. And at the same time, you know that when you have 10 children, you're lucky if two of them live beyond the age of 10. Is that a reasonable thing to ask those people? Do you think they're going to do it?
Well, the fact of the matter is, a lot more of them live beyond the age of 10, because the testing population is exploding in Africa.
Right. But in fact, it explodes, you know, even if there's only three. It doesn't have to be much. Okay, just three out of two, you get a tremendous increase. And the population is exploding, and it's exploding because we are controlling some of the death rate, but we're not controlling the conditions. We're not creating a situation where a woman has other things that she can do to fulfill her meaning in life, for example. Her main goal, her main meaning is to have children. And so what I would suggest, you can argue with that, is that what we need to do is create an equitable earth. That is an environment for the people to have a life where their primary goal is enrichment, the kinds of things that you and I have the ability to do, to study, to create, and other things of that nature. Now, what's the difficulty? The difficulty is that if this is where you're going, as somebody already mentioned, you have a problem with the energy resources. There's not enough oil to do that, certainly. And one of the things that happens is that the United States and the European countries already have used an enormous amount of energy, and already have, this building is an example, all the buildings in our country, they already have established a strong energy base, whereas South America and India and other countries have not been energy intensive. They don't have that base to begin with. And when they start competing for the energy products, what's going to happen? They're going to go up, right? And how are they going to afford them? I mean, we're going to have a hard time affording them. How are they going to afford them? And so something has to happen to the energy. We have to figure out new ways of doing things, or different ways of doing things, to supply the energy so that you can create an equitable earth. And of course, in addition to that, you have the problem of the impact on earth. That is, as you begin to, well, you can imagine if you were to take the earth and say, okay, I'm going to create an earth where people live like they do in the United States. Can you imagine the amount of CO2 that would be emitted into the atmosphere if you did that? Because correct me, Howard, is it 1 billion people in the industrial nations, and about two to three or something. It's about double for the poor countries. Yeah, it's more than double. But so what it means is that you've increased the pollution by a factor of at least two or more.
Well, you know, other than that, you can say the that population in industrial countries aren't nearly as wealthy as people in this room are, for example.
Right.
The people in this room are probably in the top 2% of the world, as far as using the resources of concern incomes.
So there's an energy problem, and there's an impact problem on the Earth. So what do I see? I see a situation right now that is out of control. Why do I say that? I say that because when I look at the Earth, there's an incredible imbalance between nations on the Earth. And I don't see that the United States and the European countries are really making an effort to do something about that imbalance. That needs to change. Why do I say it needs to be changed? Because Howard, you know, I agree that if you just leave the country alone, they're gonna devastate the land, basically. You're gonna take the land. If you're starving, you're gonna use it as much as you can so you can keep from starving. And as soon as you've done what they've done to Haiti, for example, it basically destroyed the country of Haiti, destroyed their agricultural lands, the whole thing, from what I've read. And the people then leave. I mean, they don't want to be in that environment. Where do they go? They go to the United States. So what do? We're going to let them in? So do you want an Earth where you're keeping people out that are starving to death at one time and decimating parts of the Earth because there's starvation going on?
Well, you bring them in and then we're going to starve.
Yeah.
Eventually.
You bring them in and they'll starve first.
But then we all will suffer.
The problem with immigration right now is that if you bring in the unskilled people, there's no jobs for them, they go on welfare.
Right.
And yep. You bring in the skilled people, you're hurting the country to send them. So.
Yeah. But what it suggests to me is that we need a new vision of what we're about.
How much of the wealth in the country is non-productive for life?
I don't think there's very much. I mean, if you exclude the seas and there.
No, I'm talking about the stock market, for example. Millions are made in the stock market that have no bearing at all on producing.
Right. That's true. I don't know, Mark. That's right. That's an attitude.
And money is power.
But do you see? And I don't want you to come away feeling real negative about the future. But I wanted you to see this aspect of it, the real impact, as you said, of population growth. And you can see it a little bit already in your own lives. I'm sure I've seen it. You go back to an area that you lived in when you were a youngster or even when you were 20 and go back there now. And in the Seattle area, for example, it's changed enormously. My parents have a 10-acre farm, actually a 10-acre lot, and that was 6 miles from the Everett area back 25 years ago, and now they're in the city limits. That growth is occurring everywhere, but much more so in the poor countries. And so I don't have a new vision. I have a sense of what the needs are. The population growth needs, the agricultural needs, what we need to do with the energy. I think that it's extremely important that we develop an energy source that can be used by all nations, and an energy source that isn't an isolated, that is, that populates or fills the money bags of a few nations at the expense of others. So I see that as one aspect of it, but I also see that an internal change, that is, every person has to begin to change his attitude about separate from them anymore. What happens to them is going to happen. There's going to be a consequence, a strong consequence of what happens to them. But that's not the reason why you do it. But you know that's going to happen. You do it because you're one of God's people.
What a fantastic time and opportunity for growth and invention. My gosh, you've got mother all over the place here.
Yeah. Do you understand what I'm saying? Is there a question about this process?
I have felt very much the same way in the process you described. I guess the pessimistic side of me says that I don't see the structures that are in place right now within the first world as making the changes that are going to lead to a new vision fast enough. And I truly believe that it's going to have to come from the underside, from those that, if you are coming from Christian traditions, particularly those that see that the new vision is required, that it's going to take a lot of shaking of structures that are presently keeping the machinery and the energy going to maintain the growth. Our whole basis, our whole system is based on growth and more
yeah.
and more keeping that GNP up and not just this country, but all of the first world. Somehow that has to change, at least be slowed down, and to provide incentives for new ways of thinking to come about. And I don't know where those. I would like to think that there are people with vision out there that have positions of power that could begin to start that process. Liberal Party would be one that I heard him when he was here holding once before. People with vision like that, but yet I still hear a pessimism among people, and that's breaking.
Yeah.
Well, the first thing we have to do is to see if we can't lift the side of the tent a little bit and get to the country club Christians.
Yeah.
Go in a bit farther. What do you mean by that?
Just I've got a real good example in the Mount Zion Lutheran Church, is that they don't even know that people are outside of our fence. And they don't, it's a very comfortable church, beautiful people in it, but they don't do anything.
Well, that was really all I had to say.
One of the concerns that I have in this equalizing process if there needs to be such. And it's been argued that there does need to be, and that's another seminar in itself. What about the attitude of the people in the undeveloped countries who would see population growth and all of the curtailments that may be desired as infringements on their opportunity to become like us?
Yeah, how? What is their attitude?
Yes, I see that as a tremendous impediment.
Right. Well, I think that you've got to begin to create an environment for them that allows them to be freed from some of the reasons why they would react to not being forced, for example, to 2 children per family. You've got to begin the process of giving them the resources or helping them develop the resources in the industry or whatever it happens to be to begin the process of change. And there's all kinds of, you know, I don't know how you do that exactly, except that you have to begin to invest in those countries. You have to be able to somehow create a situation where they can afford to industrialize. Because if you just take the ordinary scenario, it's clear that if you go by the capitalistic system, they're not going to be able to afford to do it, period. They're just not going to be able to do it.
That's right.
So there has to be a different structure that's developed to help them. I don't have a vision of that.
Well, as Chuck said a while ago, at this point, that's the aim throughout the undeveloped world, to become like that.
Sure.
I would take exception to that to some degree. I think that within the third world, and I say this based on some contact with third world peoples, although very limited, that there is a broader understanding that the lifestyle that has been part of the first world and the incredible lavishness in which we live is not totally a desirable thing.
Good.
Well, that's true on the part of the Christian leaders with whom I've come in contact in the third world. But it's not true of the rank and file of some of the people that I've visited in one area of the third world.
Mm.
Perhaps with the hierarchy and with the, those that want, you know, from a political perspective, perhaps. But the masses, the population, I think that certainly within probably the religious sector, I won't even just limit that to Christians, that there's an understanding that what we have, quote, as far as the lifestyle we live is not entirely.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true of leadership, but not the rank and file.
The thing that really bothers me is that how can we get this across to the people of our country that what became pretty clear to me after thinking about this for quite some time is that I don't see any holes in the argument. It's very logical. I mean, if you look at the sequence, I don't see how you're going to avoid this situation. It doesn't...
See, you talk about changing the earth. The problems you run into are, you know, how do you change people?
Yeah, right. I don't know.
To give an example, there's been a big rise in Muslim fundamentalism in Africa and places in the Middle East like that. And well, you know, it's too, but it's to a minor extent. But he's like in Saudi Arabia there during the Gulf War. Some women tried to drive cars and they were banned from doing it. Well, you get some equality in the world.
Yeah, right.
But how do you change it? How do you change their religion?
Right.
The women are second class citizens of most of the world, number wise. Mm-hmm.
The peculiar thing is that I once in a while get the rather sinking feeling that maybe our religion isn't right.
What?
Religion.
That we shouldn't give women equal rights?
No.
That's what I was talking about. The Muslims oppress them.
Only certain sinners.
Join the Missouri Synod. That's the boy.
I have the feeling that it's the way we've usually done things in the United States. We're not going to make a change until external conditions are such that we're absolutely forced to. We've practiced that a number of times, so we're pretty good at it. And there will be a number of breakthroughs. Nothing of the sort necessary to solve the problem, but kind of to stave it off, you know, so that the crisis won't come. We can kind of close our eyes and hope it'll go away. You know, like, for instance, I know there's technology available to create a refrigeration machine that works on air rather than any type of refrigerant coolant. But at this point, it's not practical because it would cost a lot more. It wouldn't be as efficient as what we presently use and so on. But those things will gradually get improved, and our cost of our living style may go up little by little, but kind of like the cost of gasoline. There was a time when we thought, a dollar a gallon, how will we manage? Well, we're doing it. We're getting along with more than a dollar, and it has affected some people's driving styles. Some, it's affected mine, I know, but a lot of people it hasn't affected a great deal. You go down the road and you see how many people are still tooling around in these things that must average all of 3 or 4 miles per gallon. We've got the money, we're spending it, we're burning up the energy. We're not about to let that interfere with our lifestyle. And until we're ready to commit ourselves to a simpler lifestyle, until we're ready for the government to commit itself, for instance, to rebuilding a rail system, which is the most efficient way of moving people or products, and get rid of all these, you know, and what's that going to do to the automobile industry? Well, there's some real problems. But until we get to that point and say, we don't have to subsidize the airline industry and say the rest of the world's got to go on its own, or subsidize the trucking industry and say, well, we don't worry about that. Those are problems that, you know, somebody's going to have to face head on. And it isn't going to happen easily because there's all these entrenched commercial interests that are not about to give that up without a fight. So,
well, what you're talking about, you're hinting towards, they're going to be losing more and more of our freedoms in the future.
The more people you have, the fewer freedoms you have.
That's right.
But I see a different element of what you said. I see the element that there's an element of hope in what you said, and I agree with that. But there's another element that you have to realize that is different. It's going to be different in the future. And let's see if I can explain that to you. I think that, in fact, the United States has acted, and a lot of the countries have acted in this laissez-faire sense, and they don't do anything until they get hit in the head with a problem. One of the things that I could see happening, and is happening, is that more and more countries are going to develop the capability of nuclear weapons. And if there's going to be a struggle for resources, then the future is a little bit different than just being able to sit back and get hit in the head. Because there are countries that, because of our technology, it's not that difficult to make an atomic bomb. Okay? It's not that difficult. And so, if I follow what you said, then the question in my mind becomes one of, do we end up with an Earth at war? Because if you don't do anything about the imbalance, that's what's going to happen, as far as I can tell.
And we're not going to curb population growth as long as there are places and beliefs in the earth that believe that the way they are going to gain power is by increased reproduction. The more people we have, the stronger we are in this.
So anyway, I would be careful about, you know, I think that the situation isn't like it has been. There's a strong need for balance.
I'm not sure how you're defining that balance, but provoke this thought in my mind: balance between our lifestyle and the lifestyles of some others. I'd like to go back to Fraser's comment earlier. I too have hope in the fact that there are some perceptions by leadership in less developed countries that are free of some of the biases that we have had and are probably forward-looking. And if we in the U.S. can only accept some of the leadership that they have to give us, affecting some changes in our attitudes, then there can be some hope in that kind of leadership. And I too see that as a part of a new vision possibility.
Anyway, I'm gonna end, and I just leave with you, and I I hope that I haven't left you with a heavy heart.
You might just describe. I'm not sure. I know your background from reading about it, but I was here when you were here last at Holden. Fascinating time, because Gerald Marnie was one of the ones on the program.
Right.
I've really been taken by some of his ideas and also very despairing, I guess, with some of the incredible roadblocks he ran into within the structures of government and trying to do something about that. But mm-hmm. Have you been in communication with some of these people at all? Have you
know what some of their recent thinking is in relation to this problem?
No, I haven't. One of the things that I've toyed with, you're probably aware of the fact that there is a mathematical model that incorporates population growth resources. I think there's five main areas. And one of the things that I've been concerned about is that one of the roles of Los Alamos National Laboratory is security of the nation. And I believe it's an area that we should actually be involved in.
Security in what?
Security in the sense of looking at, typically when Los Alamos has been involved in security, in the past it was force, you know, develop a nuclear weapons, the SDI program and things like that. But it's much broader than that. It's security in terms of technology transfer, you name it. And it's clear to me that the people in government, people in the laboratory need to be thinking about, even though they're not necessarily Christians, they need to see the consequences of this interaction between pollution, growth, resources, and so on, that you can develop as a result of this modeling. Because the security, not only of the United States, but the security of North America, security of the globe, appears to me to depend very much on the laboratories looking at these things and with much more care. Germany has looked at this, I know. Barney and some other people came up with a model about 20 years ago. About 5 years ago, that model was updated by the Germans. I don't know what the status is right now, but it's certainly an area that Los Alamos could study in a lot of depth. We have this is a situation where you need a computer to look at the interaction between all of the different areas. And we have the largest computing facility in the world. And so I've thought about that a lot. And there are ways of trying to get funding to begin that process.
I think that's part of the whole new vision, our redefinition of security. That's certainly something that has plagued my thinking for a long time. And it's been a very, I think, what we define as security oftentimes is our own, what's in our own best interest, and security has to do with how do we defend against somebody else getting into what we have.
And fortifications, a wall to keep out.
Right.
And that is, that there has to be a new vision, new definition of security, I think, for.
That's correct. Anyway, I still have a lot of hope in our future, and I think there's a lot of things that we can do, and there are things that I personally, as I've already indicated, I wasn't going to mention that, but there are things that I personally am involved in that give me hope. Fusion energy is one of them, because I see that as a source of energy that could be available to almost every country on Earth. It's going to take technology, but the fuel is there, and it's not something that's isolated. The other thing is to begin to get a better understanding of the future of the Earth in relationship to population growth and the imbalance of nations, and try to understand how we might begin the process of creating a a world in which there isn't that imbalance, a world which is safer for all of us, one in which we can interact in a meaningful and not conflicting way.
It's going to do right now is to write to our commerce people and have them fund population control methods through the UN, for one thing, which we've cut off because of the abortion.
But again, you know, you can do that only if you begin the other process too. You're not going to control the population in a meaningful way if you don't change their environment.
Well, there's already some research to indicate that any place where people have some security in knowing they will have adequate food and medical care and shelter, that the population will pretty much control itself.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And that's one of the fundamental issues.
That's somewhat contradictory, though, because in this country, for example, the biggest growing part of the population is the poor. They're on the welfare. They're secure.
That's not really security.
That depends.
No, I don't think it is. I think that there's...
Not security in the sense that the word ought to be used, but I don't
know.